Old Ben Weaver was a mean man. You know any mean people? Could we turn the volume down just a little bit? Oh, there's Trey up there. Trey, I don't know if you snuck out a minute ago. He did our pre-service music and did a fabulous job. And now you're running the sound. He is a man of many talents. Thank you, brother. That sounds better now. Ben Weaver was a mean man. He appears as the villain in the early years of the Andy Griffith Show. So there's this 1961 episode in which we meet the family of Lester and Helen Scobie and their little girl, Mary. They are a loving, hard-working family, but they have fallen on hard times. It seems that Lester has lost his job. And for the first time ever, he misses his mortgage payment that he owes to the mean man, Ben Weaver. The payment, his monthly payment, was $52.50. Well, old Ben Weaver shows up at the sheriff's office and he demands that Andy foreclose on the property because they missed a payment. Andy visits the Scobies and he discovers they're doing everything they can to make ends meet. And Andy also learns that Ben Weaver's real motive is he wants to tear that house down and put up a warehouse. And so Andy and Barney, who are the good guys, they take the $52.50 out of their own pocket and they pay Ben Weaver, but Ben refuses to accept the payment, saying, because the Scobies missed their payment, the entire mortgage is now due. A total of $780. This was 1961. When Ben storms out of this sheriff's office, Andy looks at Barney and he delivers one of the classic lines of the Andy Griffith Show. He said, "Barney, when that man's time comes to go, he ain't gonna go like everybody else. He's just gonna nasty away." The psalmist who wrote this 36th psalm that Debbie read for us, he may have had somebody like Ben Weaver in mind. People who are just plain mean-spirited, and one day they're just going to nasty away. He wrote the words of their mouth are evil and dishonest. And in the fourth verse, and there's a Jewish translation that reads, "He devises trouble as he lies in bed. So set is he on his own bad way that he doesn't hate evil." They're mean men, and then there are evil men. Robert Edward Chambliss was an evil man. His nickname was Dynamite Bob. He was a member of the Klan, and he had the ability to devise dynamite bombs that he used on a number of houses of African Americans. But in 1963, he worked on his most destructive bomb that was designed not for a house, but for a church. The 36th Psalm begins by talking about evil people, mean people, godless people. But just when you think that the psalmist is about to go off on these people with judgment and condemnation and harsh words, he changes course and he speaks words of love and hope. He turns his focus away from the mean people and the evil people, and he turns his focus to God, and he lifts up his heart to heaven. He looks above to see the mountains, to see the clouds, and to see the heavens. He proclaims, "Thy steadfast love extends to the heavens, thy faithfulness to the clouds, thy righteousness to the mountains." What the psalmist is telling us is rather than repay evil for evil, rather than continue to walk in the darkness looking down at the ground, he's telling us to look up. To look up and see the stars. To look up and see the glory of God's greatness. To look up and see his steadfast love and his righteousness and his faithfulness that never fails and will remain forever. People who are in the public are often criticized, whether it's an elected office, a public office, whether it's a leader in the church, a leader in an organization. If you are in the public eye, there are always going to be people who are going to criticize you, and they're going to say bad things about you. I mean, that just comes with the territory. But it's one thing to criticize a leader. It's another thing to criticize a leader's family. And it's even another thing on a whole different level to seek to inflict harm on a leader's family. This is the weekend that we're celebrating the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. I believe a critical defining moment in the civil rights movement that was even more powerful than the I Have a Dream speech in 1963 was what happened one night in Montgomery, Alabama, when Dr. King was pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church and the bus boycott was just gaining momentum. You know, when Rosa Parks, have you studied that in history? When Rosa Parks said she was not going to get up and give her seat to a white man, and it led to the bus boycott. And one night, Dr. King, who became the leader of that, was speaking to a group of over 1,000 people. And the word came that a bomb had gone off at his house. A bomb had exploded at his house. His wife, his baby were in that house. Can you imagine what he was thinking when he rushed back to the house? We talked about this a little bit in our Thursday morning Bible study, and I told the guys, I said, I don't know that I would have had the courage. I don't know if I would have been able to continue knowing that my family had been targeted, not just with criticism, but with injury and even death. The amazing thing that happened was when Dr. King arrived at the house, he immediately went inside to make sure that his wife and his baby were okay. But he had something else he had to deal with, because when the news got out about the bombing, an angry mob was gathering around his house that had just been bombed. And these people had weapons. And these people had torches. And these people were angry. And these people were ready to take action. These people were ready to go out and burn Montgomery, Alabama to the ground. And let me tell you, if that had happened, the civil rights movement would have been stopped in its tracks. But let me tell you what Dr. King did. And these are the words of Taylor Branch in that amazing book, Parting the Waters. He said Dr. King walked out of the house, and holding up his hand for silence, he tried to still the anger by speaking with an exaggerated peacefulness in his voice. He said, "Everything's okay. Everything's all right. Don't get panicky. Don't do anything panicky. Don't get your weapons. If you have weapons, take them home. He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword. Remember, that's what Jesus said. We're not advocating violence. We want to love our enemies. I want you to love our enemies. Be good to them. This is what we must live by. We must meet hate with love. That's what the psalmist is saying. In the face of hatred, we must respond with love. We must always meet darkness with light and hatred with love. And the Word, and those of you that studied this in Sunday school, my good friend Tony Cartledge talks about the word for steadfast love. In Hebrew, it is the word hesed. And the word, according to Tony, is, he says, this is the quintessential Old Testament description of God's character and His care for humankind. You know, we're always going to have mean people, aren't we? There are going to be mean people like Ben Weaver. And we're always going to have evil people like Bob Chambliss. But what the psalmist says is we don't need to focus on them. But we need to focus on the steadfast love of our sovereign God, who will always be there for us, always providing for us, even in the midst of evil. For we have a God who prepares a table for us, even in the presence of our enemies. There's one thing that I think we always need to keep in mind when we're studying the Gospels. Jesus was being constantly criticized, and His life was being threatened. John brings this out clearer than anyone else. The gospel lesson that Debbie shared with us started with the seventh chapter, in the seventh chapter of John. Let me read to you how this seventh chapter of John begins. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee, because He could not go about in Judea, that's where Jerusalem is, because the Jews were out to kill Him. It wasn't safe for Jesus to travel to Jerusalem because they were out to kill Him. The most amazing thing happens. It's an interesting dialogue. You know, the Jewish people, the ones who were faithful, would always attend the festivals. They'd go to Passover. They'd go to Pentecost. And they'd go to Tabernacles. In the seventh chapter of John, it tells us the festival of Tabernacles was at hand. Of all the Jewish festivals, Tabernacles was the most joyous. Wes, you would have loved it. There was music. There were bands. There were choirs. People were singing. People were dancing. Now, they're Jewish. They're not Baptists, so they could do that. But everybody was happy. Everybody was rejoicing. So the Scripture tells us that Jesus' brothers, his the sons of Mary and Joseph, they come and say, look, brother, we're going down to the festival. You need to go with us. Jesus said, no, I can't go. He goes on and says, you know, my time has not yet come, which is His way of saying it's not safe for me to go. But then He does go. He probably is kind of flying undercover. He's there not wanting anybody to know who He was. But then an amazing thing happens. It begins with the water ceremony. And those of you who were with us in Israel back earlier this year, you remember we were standing in the city of David, and we looked up to where the temple was, and we looked down to where the pool of Siloam was, and we were pointing out that at the water ceremony, everybody would gather at the temple, and the choirs would be there, and the bands would be there, the instrumentalists, and the priests, they would gather all of the holy vessels. And they would begin this journey to the Pool of Siloam. I mean, it wouldn't be a journey. It would be a procession. It would be a parade. They would be singing and dancing and rejoicing. And they would go to the Pool of Siloam. And they would fill up those vessels. And then there would be even more rejoicing. They would go back to the temple. And it was in the midst of this that suddenly Jesus blows his cover. And he stands up and he said, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink." And that night, we just got better at nighttime, because they would light all of these torches and all of these fires. Now imagine an ancient city all aglow at night. And it was in the middle of the festival at night that Jesus stood and said, "I am the light of the world. And if you follow me, you will not walk in the darkness." Wow. His life was on the line. But he chose to focus on the light rather than the darkness. September the 15th, 1963. Four precious little girls. Addie Mae Collins, Denise McNair, Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, dressed in their Sunday finest, these beautiful little dresses, and they went to Sunday school at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. This story resonates with me because the very same time that they were in Sunday school, I was in Sunday school just a few miles away. They heard a Sunday school lesson that day titled, "A Love That Forgives." And it was a story about Joseph. You know that amazing story in the book of Genesis? His brothers hated him. They were jealous. And so they decided to get rid of him. And they were going to kill him. But they sold him into slavery, and then he goes to Egypt, and then first of all he's a slave, and he ends up in prison, and then somehow he's elevated to the second most important position in all of Egypt. And then his brothers come, and he recognizes, "These are my brothers," and you remember what he says to them? He forgives them, and he said, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." He chose to look at the light rather than the darkness. That was the Sunday school lesson for those little girls. The last words they heard were forgiveness before a bomb constructed by the evil man Dynamite Bob exploded. And those four little girls, precious little girls, were killed. Most observers of the civil rights movement believe this one horrific event devised by a heart of evil did more to turn the hearts of Americans to the light and to goodness and to justice than anything else. And Dr. King was prophetic. In his moving funeral eulogy, he said, "And so, my friends, they did not die in vain. God still has a way of wringing good out of evil. And history has proven over and over that the unmerited suffering is redemptive. The innocent blood of these little girls may well serve as a redemptive force that will one day bring new light to this dark city." And it did. Because Dr. King knew that there was a power that was greater than the force of dynamite, and that is the power of love. He knew there was a power that was greater than the force of evil, and that is forgiveness. You all remember that great sermon that Bishop Michael Curry preached at the royal wedding? Michael Curry is the new rock star of preachers. You know that, don't you? And even though he's an Episcopalian, he actually is the bishop of the Episcopal Church in our nation. You know where he learned to preach. Because I was in a conference with him a number of years ago, and he told us, he said, when I was a little boy, I'd spend the summer with my grandmother, and we would go to Baptist revivals. He said, that's where I learned to preach. And so Michael Curry stood before that staid British audience, and he said, there is power in love. There's power in love to help and to heal when nothing else will. There's power to lift up and to liberate when nothing else will. There's power in love to show us the way to live. And then he looked at that audience in historic St. George's Chapel, and he asked them to stop and to imagine a world where love is the way. He said, imagine our homes and our families when love is the way. Imagine neighborhoods and communities when love is the way. Imagine governments and nations where love is the way. Imagine business and commerce when love is the way. Imagine this tired old world when love is the way. He said, when love is the way, unselfish, sacrificial, redemptive, when love is the way, listen, then no child will go to bed hungry in this world ever again. When love is the way, we will let justice roll down like a mighty stream and righteousness like an ever-flowing brook. When love is the way, poverty will become history. When love is the way, this earth will be a sanctuary. When love is the way, we will lay down our swords and our shields down by the riverside and we'll study war no more. When love is the way, there'll be plenty of room for all of God's children. When love is the way, we will actually treat each other, well, we'll treat each other like we're family. When love is the way, we know that God is the source of us all, and we're brothers, and we're sisters, and we're children of God. And he said, brothers and sisters, that's called a new heaven and a new earth, a new world, and a new human family. And then he said, Dr. King was right. We must discover love, the redemptive power of love. And when we do that, we'll be able to make of this old world a new world. Dynamite Bob never, ever expressed any remorse over what he did. It was 14, 15 years later before he was even convicted. He never asked for forgiveness. He had a heart of evil. But there was a man named Alfred. He was born in Stockholm, Sweden. His father owned an arms factory. Alfred was a smart young man, and he worked in the factory, and he started conducting experiments with chemistry and explosives. And he is the person who developed dynamite. In 1888, Alfred's brother died. The local newspaper, Chad, this never would have happened if you had been the editor. The local newspaper got confused. They thought Alfred had died. And so they ran a story about Alfred's death. The headline was, "The Merchant of Death is Dead." And the article went on to talk about Alfred inventing dynamite, stating he became rich by finding ways to kill more people faster than ever. Well, Alfred read that. Can you imagine how that made him feel? And he said to himself, I don't want to be remembered this way. And he changed his life. Rather than looking down, he decided to look up. And he took his substantial estate and left his vast fortune to establish a prestigious international award for those who do the greatest work for humankind. And in 1964, Martin Luther King received the award that was established by the creator of dynamite, Dr. Alfred Nobel. And Martin Luther King, the Baptist preacher, said, as he received the Nobel Peace Prize, "I have the audacity to believe that peoples everywhere can have 3 meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits. I still believe that one day mankind will bow before the altars of God and will be crowned triumphant over war and bloodshed, and non-redemptive goodwill will be proclaimed the rule of the land. I still believe that we shall overcome. We shall overcome when we meet hatred and darkness and violence with love and justice and forgiveness and grace." And all of God's people said, amen.